I guess it's been quite a while since we talked to you. So were you surprised by the stunning success of Nickel and Dimed?
Well, yes. Yeah, nothing like that ever happened to a book that I wrote before. So, you know, it's great, and it continues to cling to the bottom of the New York Times paperback bestseller list. So people are still reading it and passing it around.
What do you attribute it to?
I don't know. You know, it seemed to me and my editor at the, you know, when it came out in the late spring, early summer of 01, the economy was beginning to soften. The dot-com boom had bust, and that had something to do with it. People who could afford, at that point it was just a hardcover book, were beginning to think of, well, what lies below them. You know, we were starting to read about dot-com moguls working in Starbucks, you know, after the loss of their dot-com fortunes, of course. So I don't know, but I'll say what really pleases me is that it has gotten out to a lot of the kinds of people who are in these situations in a long-term kind of way. You know, I run into surprising people, front desk clerks in hotels and waitresses and so on who have read it. So that makes me feel good.
So it's not just the usual gang of intellectuals and policy wonks who've read it?
I don't think so, no. In fact, I have a website, nickelanddime.net, which I created to post people's stories on when people would write to me and tell me their story, their life as a low-wage worker. And it's also a place people can communicate with each other. So please, if you are a low-wage worker, you have something to say to other low-wage workers, check out nickelanddime.net. That's one big word, nickel and dimed.
Now, what about the political reaction? There's certainly a great popular reaction to it, but do you see low-wage work, the problem of the working poor, which is a very large portion of the employed population in the United States, is this reaching any kind of political salience, or is this just one of these things that people kind of cluck their tongues and say it's an unfortunate fact of nature?
Well, are the people who are the working poor themselves getting politically mobilized?
No, well, that, but also just in the people who set political agendas and such, are they paying more attention?
Yeah, I guess
they pay some
attention, some of them, but both Dean and I understand Kerry have referred to Nickel and Dimed in their writings or talks. You know, a number of Democratic senators and congresspeople, when it first came out, invited me to Washington, and they say, oh, yeah, we've got to do something about this. Boy, we're going to raise that minimum wage. Nothing happened, but I don't know. I think that, you know, I don't know if that's really how social change happens, you know, getting the attention of the powerful and hoping that they do something. But it has gotten out there, and I think there is more attention now to the working poor as a category. I don't even like saying the working poor because it implies that there's some great big bunch of non-working poor, which there really isn't. You know, we'll see. There's an interesting thing happening in Florida, where I'm talking to you from right this minute, where Acorn is trying to get a referendum on the ballot next November to raise state's minimum wage. You know, states can choose to raise their minimum wage for their state, and a number of states like Oregon, Washington, California have. So Florida should do that. And the Acorn's idea is also that would maybe lure a lot of low-income people who might not ordinarily vote to the polls for the presidential election, too.
I think you had a piece in The Nation a while back, declaring that you'd sort of despaired of the benign powers of the state, and I think I'm thinking economist Brad DeLong, among other people, complained that on the one hand you were indicting the system of low wage labor, on the other hand, kind of doubting the power of state remedies. Is he misunderstanding you? Is there some contradiction there that we don't understand?
Well, what I was trying to point out in that article in The Nation is that, you know, we are seeing, and have been seeing for some time now, a dramatic change in the functions of the state. It's not being shrunk as the right, you know, used to say they wanted to do. But what has happened is that the helping functions, the social welfare functions, for example, have been shrinking, while those things that have to do with the use of force have been increasing as a part of it. So that domestically, the trend has been over time more emphasis on prisons, less on schools, etc. And the question I was raising was, is there a point when you can no longer turn to that state to increase helping functions, which we all know we want, because it has become too much of a, I'll use the phrase, police state, that we're well down that path. So I was raising a rather large question. Now, I continue to say, maybe it's not too late. Maybe we could turn this around and have a government, and I mean both state and federal here, that is providing people with things like health care that, and so on, that we really need, and stop in this long-term trend just toward the more punitive and coercive functions.
Yeah, I think some social democrats were afraid you'd turn into an anarchist or something and give it up on the state.
Well, I have those leanings. I definitely have those leanings.
Now, something else that was rather controversial, probably more so, was what you wrote about maids or domestic labor and the relation to the feminist movement and how the organized feminism in the United States has largely forgotten about the domestic labor debates of the 70s. And people like the economist Barbara Bergman are very critical of your work, saying that without domestic help, women can't have independent professional careers.
Did she say that?
She did indeed. she said, and rather pointedly, she said that.
Let's go back to that. And I said this both in Nickel and Dimed and then in a long essay on the politics of housework for Harper's, we really have to think about this evolving servant culture. Now, I should say it's concentrated in the top 20% of Americans in terms of income. But that top 20% increasingly does have paid people who come in and take care of the children and clean the house and so forth, and even maybe do more expansive kinds of white-collar functions within the home, like monitoring, setting up birthday parties and everything. Now, it's the maid part, the person who does the really grubby work, that I was most concerned with in those essays. And I was talking about the conditions, the low pay on average of people who do that work, the trend toward away from the independent maid to the one who works for a corporate house cleaning service and, works in a team, gets paid very low wages. I had done this work while working on Nickel and Dimed, and the starting pay was $6.63 an hour where I worked, and lower in some of the places I investigated. Anyway, under terrible conditions, too, I might add, but I'm not going to go on and on into that. So I was just trying to raise all these questions, and I think what got a lot of people mad at me is I did say that personally I don't have somebody who cleans my house. I never have. I haven't liked it. I don't like the idea of having that relationship to another woman. I don't think it's evil to do so. If you pay well enough and provide benefits and some kind of job security, fine. But anyway, this elicited all sorts of comments. One of the worst insults I've ever gotten was resulted from this, was somebody calling me the, quote, Martha Stewart of the left, because it seemed so odd to them that somebody would want to do their own housework. Well, 80% of us Americans do our own housework, and I stand by that. But I think if we're going to continue to have that kind of defensiveness about this issue, we'll never have an honest political discussion of this servant culture that has arisen in the upper middle class.
I guess some of your critics are just focusing on the women and letting the men in their lives off the hook.
No, our goal in the 70s, when we talked about the politics of housework, was to get the men to do it, too. you know, that we thought this should be shared. Never occurred to us that you try to solve this problem by hiring another woman to do it, but that you know, it would be shared between the man and woman of the house, and I would say the kids ought to pitch in too. I see the, and I think you can make a pretty good case for this in terms of, just as a historical change, that the shift to using paid people, maids, was really a lot of women giving up on having that argument with their husbands or their boyfriends. You know, there are cleaning services that advertise, we can save your marriage. Don't have that fight. Just bring in another woman. Now, if you're going to argue that this is, you know, insensitive to the needs of professional women, and they wouldn't be able to have their careers if they didn't have maids, I say, well, first, what happened to the men in their lives, if any? And secondly, what about some professional great career opportunities for those women who were cleaning their toilets? Aren't they also part of the feminist constituency that we're concerned about?
Bringing in women to do this kind of domestic work brings me to a topic of the book that you and Arlie Hochschild edited, The Global Woman.
Global Woman.
The Global Woman. Okay.
Yeah.
The women who are brought in are frequently from very far away. So could you talk about this new kind of almost invisible imperialism of personal and even emotional service?
Yeah, this is what one of the interesting things that's been happening is that in the wealthier parts of the world, which the United States counts as on the whole, it's increasingly immigrant women who do this domestic work. It's not likely to be an African-American woman as it was in the, say, 1950s. It's likely to be a Mexican woman or a woman from the Philippines or the Caribbean, something like that. So that's a big change. And in Global Woman, Arlie and I were calling attention to the fact of this enormous migration of poor women from poor countries to rich countries to be the nannies and the maids. It's a flow, say, from Mexico and the Philippines to the United States, from the Philippines to Hong Kong, from Sri Lanka to the Middle East, from Northern Africa to Southern Europe, etc. You can sort of chart these little flows around the world. What Arlie wrote in this, Arlie Hochschild is a sociologist at UC Berkeley, is that, you know, in taking, especially for the nanny work, you're taking women away from their own children who were left behind in the Philippines or Mexico or wherever, and then they come and take care of the children of people in a wealthy country. And that, she argues, is a kind of like a new phase of imperialism where you're not extracting gold or rubber or something like that from the other parts of the world. You're extracting love and human caring. And leaving, you know, those children left behind don't get it. They may be deprived of a mother's presence for years at a time. And in our book, Global Woman, you know, we have cases like that. Just not seeing their children grow up at all, you know, except for occasional phone calls, while providing all this very intense care for kids somewhere else in the world.
Years ago, migration was mainly an affair of men, and now it's become, with people talking about the feminization of migration, right?
Yeah. It's this demand for domestics is a very important part of that.
But a lot of the women who make these trips are very often the most qualified and ambitious in their country. They're not generally the poorest and most downtrodden, right?
That's right. And this was sort of a surprise to me. But it really painfully illustrates global inequalities. A Philippine school teacher can make more money cleaning houses in Hong Kong than she can teaching school. And so it's often the kind of ambitious women, the women who have another language, who will make these huge migrations, so they can send back money to their kids.
And that money becomes very important both at the personal level for the families, but even for the countries involved. Remittances figure in their balance of payments.
Yeah, there's been the remittances have been a very important part of the economies of places like Sri Lanka, with the government encouraging women to migrate for work. Though there's some second thoughts, and as you know, in our book, there's an article about this in the Philippines, where there's a whole public debate about what's happening to the kids left behind. You know, are they how are they losing out? You know, are they you know, more likely to be in trouble and et cetera.
What are we? What kind of policy responses do we, in the face of these kinds of migrations, which are, you know, first of all, are we in favor in principle of the idea of free migration of people and open borders? If so, you know, what kind of policies should governments adopt in response to these movements?
Yeah, I'm certainly in favor of the freedom of movement and the chance for women to, you know, seize whatever opportunities present themselves. But I think, for one thing, there would need to be more governmental involvement to see that women are not abused. I mean, at the worst level is coming here, finding, you know, some really abusive employers and having them take your passport away and say, well, you don't go outdoors anymore. It's real enslavement. And there is a group, by the way, in Washington, D.C., that works on cases of enslaved domestics. It's a group called Break the Chains, and it's located at the Institute for Policy Studies. So that's, you know, that the worst abuses could be, there could be some kind of reporting system, you know, where there's some kind of checkup on these women after they get here to make sure that they haven't been put into, into essentially a situation of slavery. And then I think if we, you know, other things would be, and I don't know how to do this in terms of policy, but I would like to see encouragement for these women to be able to get together, domestic, to have sort of gathering places somewhere. Now, this is things that, you know, maybe the feminist movement could provide or someone. And, you know, beginnings of some kind of unionization would be great, get together and be able to demand money, enough money, for example, to go home on a regular basis and see your own kids.
Yeah, these women often work lives of great isolation, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, imagine. You come to a country where you may not speak the language or very poorly speak the language. You don't know anything or anybody, and you just have your little room, if you're lucky enough to have a room, inside the home of your employers, who can renege on everything that was promised. You know, even if they don't abuse you, it might turn out that you're not being paid what you thought you were, or that your hours are really pretty open-ended. You know, from when the baby gets up at 6 to when the dinner guests are gone at 10 or something like that.
This flows of women are often invisible.
Yeah, it's really invisible, because it's not like industrial workers or even day laborers who gather. You know, you can see the day laborers will be shaping up for jobs on the street. You can, you know, go by a factory gate and see people streaming in. But this is privatized. It's divided. Of course, the most hidden, it would be those women who are enslaved as prostitutes in the, trafficking of women, and who may never be able to leave their brothels. So there's it's easily ignored.